Flying two is the shortest distance between two points, and morally speaking, it is also the most effective and efficient way to live. You can be sure that the narrow way that leads to life is a straight course. There's no meandering, no deviations. I'd like to start with actually a passage in the Old Testament, Joshua chapter 1, verse 7 and 8. This is where God is commissioning Joshua after Moses has just died. And says, Joshua, you need to take the reins here, and this is what I need you to do. He says, be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do all according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Reason why I like this passage is because if you change just a few key words, it fits exactly what we are pledging to do ourselves. It becomes, in essence, a kind of mission statement for Christians. Plot a course straight ahead. It has to be guided by the Word of God. Don't turn your feet to the right or to the left. Go straight ahead. And God says, that will be prosperous for you, and you will have success. Here's the problem, and this is what we're confronting this whole weekend, is that Christians do not live in a vacuum, in a sterile environment where there's no external forces working on us, there's no influences that are trying to affect us in a different way of thinking. We are not only the product of whatever generation that we grew up in, but if we're not careful, we'll follow the way of our own generation, and we'll make the mistakes of that generation. We have seen in the last 50 years that America has been taking a path of least resistance, and sadly and frighteningly, a lot of Christians are following. And I don't mean like following like they're just bailing out of the churches. It's worse than that. Actually, they're bringing these things into the churches and then trying to get churches to change to conform to that. Here's one of the things that we're plagued with. Our society is plagued with a mentality called postmodernism. You can look it up sometime. Please don't do it right now, okay? But postmodernism really is the deliberate destruction of sacred truths and venerated traditions and a respect for authority. It's basically tearing down anything that has been the pillars, the stanchions of society up until now. And now people are sifting through the rubble. They're plucking pieces from the wreckage, not hoping to find some objective truth, not hoping to find some truth that is transcendent in nature and will work for all time and for all people. People are looking for a truth that works for them. My truth. That's what people want right now. I don't know if you've noticed that, but if you tried to share the gospel with anyone in the world, you have probably run into this mentality, whether they know what it's called or not. And under the directionless and rudderless and even soulless context of postmodernism, people are not really interested in truth. What they really are interested in is feelings. The I think, I feel, I believe mantra is extremely popular. Many people are using that as their basis for how they think, how they believe, and how they live. People are not interested in talking. People are not interested in discourse and dialogue. They are rather interested in, well, if I could just say it this way, cramming their view down the throat of another. I will say this as a personal observation. I have never seen in my lifetime a generation so unprepared, so unable, and so unwilling to talk factually and intelligently about anything. That is where we are today. Every conversation ultimately and quickly disintegrates into an ad hominem attack, and that's a fancy Latin phrase which means against the person. It becomes a character attack. It becomes a personal attack. Never mind about the facts. Never mind about the problem. Never mind about the core discussion. You must be wrong because you're a knucklehead, or because you believe in this thing, or because of this thing that you are. It turns into that. So slander, character assassination, name calling. This is what we get from all of this today. Few people know what an argument actually is versus an opinion, or how to use an argument. People claim they want justice, but really what they want is their own version of justice, things to work out in their favor. This is all part of postmodernism. They want it to work out according to their worldview. What people want, and I have seen this so many times myself, I've run into this personally, they want a validation of their feelings and their opinions. Never mind about what God says or the Bible or truth or anything like that. I just need you to validate that what I believe is real and is sufficient and that everything's going to work out okay in the end. There is no absolute standard in postmodernism. And there's a lot of implications to that. People are not interested in the betterment of our society and our nation. They are interested in their own personal interests, especially their own financial and political interests. And if you disagree with them, well, then you are not allowed to have a voice because obviously you're an intolerant Neanderthal bigot and you can't possibly know what's going on unless, of course, you agree with those people. In fact, in some parts of the world, you're not even allowed to live. I wonder how long that's going to take to come here. And of course, sadly, God, Jesus Christ, the Bible, Christianity, and Christians themselves really have no place in the postmodern mindset. If anything, we are enemies. Postmodernism claims that there is no God, claims that no religion is better than another. That claims that there is no moral standards. There is no truth. There's no transcendent standard for right or wrong or good or evil. There is no divine authority. And at the crux of it all, there is no soul. You have no soul. So this is all we have right here. And what we have to work with is a bunch of people who are really whining and complaining and unable to put together a cogent argument, not even understanding what an argument is, not worried about facts and evidence and truth, but rather focusing on feelings and emotions. I'd like you to turn with me to 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1 through 5. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1 through 5. Paul tells his protege, Timothy, he says, "But realize this, that in the last days difficult times will come. For men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure than lovers of God, holding to a form of godliness even though they have denied its power." He goes on to say, "Avoid such men as these." This is what we're seeing everywhere. We must be in the last times. So what do we do? Jesus' firm answer is stay the narrow course. The Holy Spirit says stay on the path that leads to righteousness. God says in so many words, preach the truth. These are all right answers, of course, given the source and the authority that that source holds. There's no question of that. Here's the problem, is that all of this is getting harder to do, not easier. Being faithful requires more effort, not less. But this is not what we're seeing across the board in so many churches. We're not seeing more effort given toward this. We're seeing less effort. You and I ought to be more concerned, not less concerned, about what is happening. This is not always the case. The attention to preaching and evangelism and church work ought to be given more time and more concern, not less concern. But we can't oversimplify the solution either and just say, well, if we just busy ourselves with church work, then everything's going to be okay, because that's not really the answer in itself. Jesus' Sermon on the Mount is Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7 there. There's a singular theme that runs all the way through it, and that theme is, in essence, not a call for gospel meetings and vacation Bible schools and, you know, more church activity. Rather, it is a call for an uncompromising inward devotion of one's heart to the Lord, period. Because if we have that, then all the other things will follow. That's what we need. That's what Jesus says. We cannot save the entire world, but we can save one soul at a time. And so with the progress of the church, it moves forward with one committed, dedicated heart at a time. And we're not talking about the other guy's heart here right now. We're talking about yours, just as I would be talking about mine. So our series focuses on an individual return to what we call biblical morality. If we could have a subtitle to this series, that's what it would be, a return to biblical morality. Morality is really whatever God says is right and pure and just and holy. Whatever reflects his own divine nature is our morality. It is the speaker's belief, collective belief, that many Christians have strayed from the path of that morality and are often oblivious to the straying. In other words, people are getting off the path, but they don't even know they're getting off the path because it's not something that happens abruptly. It's something that happens slowly and gradually. And you say, well, why is that happening? Well, part of the reason is a lack of attention to the word itself, a lack of gratitude for being forgiven. Sadly, I hate to even say this, but a lack of interest in Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. Part of the reason, too, is the distractions of the world itself. You know that, as well as I do, that people would rather sit down to an Avengers movie series rather than a 45-minute Bible study. Or they would rather play video games for hours on end, all night if necessary, rather than a devotion to God and a prayerful one at that. Or binge-watching on their favorite TV shows rather than coming together as Christians to find out what God has to say. Part of the reason, too, is at a time when we ought to be strong and prepared and focused because of all the stuff going on all around us here, we are allowing ourselves to be weak and soft and undisciplined. And that makes us vulnerable, easily defeated. We're not putting on the full armor, not all of us anyway. And we're not like Joshua. We're not listening to what God said to Joshua. And thankfully, here's the good news. All this can change. I hope that all this does change. I hope, personally, that this weekend becomes a resolve for everyone who comes to this series to change for the better. One soul, one heart, one decision, one victory at a time. I'll paint a picture for you here. Imagine you're in a jet airliner. You're in a moonless night. The sky is filled with clouds. You're flying over a mountain range. Then there's a malfunction in the plane. The plane loses all navigation controls. You can't tell how high you are, how fast you're going, what direction you're going, or what lies in front of you. Sounds like a pretty horrifying situation, doesn't it? Now I want you to imagine that same opening there where we've lost all navigation controls, but instead of a malfunction, what's happened here is a number of passengers have gone through and started pulling all the lines, the electrical lines, and pulling fuses and cutting the hydraulic lines to the plane, slicing the lines, and the result is the same. They're flying blind. But instead of being horrified, people are saying, hey, you know what? We should just enjoy the flight. Listen to some music, have a snack, take a nap, watch a movie. It's all going to be okay. Besides, we don't want to offend anybody by telling them the truth of the matter. The fact is, when you're flying at 500 miles an hour at 25,000 feet, it doesn't feel like it, does it? There's no wind. There may not even be any sense of speed or even movement in some cases. But this doesn't mean that you're automatically out of danger, especially if you don't know where you're going and you've lost all sense of direction. I've just described our American society as it is becoming over time and very quickly. This illustrates our present society because we have disabled our country. We have yanked the wires, we have pulled the fuses, we've sliced the hydraulic lines, we have sabotaged the machine, if you will. And now we are flying blind, but it doesn't seem like people are interested in the here and now, and more interested rather in the here and now than what will happen eventually if we keep on flying blind. There's a reason why bikes have handlebars. There's a reason why cars have steering wheels. And there's a reason why planes have navigation systems. First of all, because they can't get to where they need to go if they don't have them. And secondly, they will crash. All of those will crash and cause great injury to whoever's riding them. Likewise, there's a reason why God gave us the evidence of his existence and his divine authority, and his revealed truth, and this written record we call the Bible. He's given us morality and the model example of his own son. First of all, because we can't get to where we need to go without all that. And secondly, if we don't have that, we're going to crash. We're going to crash hard. We're flying blind. We're going to perish without all those. The secular world thinks that all these things are just slowing us down and keeping us from being, what's the popular word, progressive today. And from moving forward. And the fact is, these are the very things that drive nations and give them forward momentum, give them direction. Without that, we are flying blind. Imagine saying, you know, you're in a car with someone, and they say, you know, we don't need the steering wheel, you know, throws it out the window. Well, that might sound good for a moment, but that's going to have a very bad ending. Jeremiah chapter 10, 23, I know some of the other men are probably going to quote this later. I know that because I saw it in their slideshow. I know, O Lord, that a man's way is not in himself, nor is it in a man who walks to direct his steps. Well, that was written about 2,600 years ago, roughly. Since human nature has not changed in 2,600 years, it is still true. Left to ourselves, we will take the path of least resistance, and we will sow the seeds of our own destruction. We're told in Judges chapter 21, verse 25 there, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That worked out really well, didn't it? Anyone who knows their Old Testament knows that that resulted in years and even centuries of problems. As the infamous Dr. Phil would ask, how's that working for you, right? And just think, if we did the same thing, if everyone's going to just do what's right in their own eyes, that is just not going to work out any better for us. We have historical precedent that that is going to fail. But that is exactly what people want to do. I'm not saying people are not intelligent or clever or innovative or even resilient. The problem we're dealing with here is spiritual in nature, not material. It's not mechanical. It's not earthly. In other words, not talking about building a bridge or designing a car or programming a computer. We're talking about saving a soul from its own corruption. You all probably know someone in your life who can fix anything. I know there's always that fix-it guy. It's not me, by the way. I can't. I call Roy, okay? But there's always that guy that can fix everything. He's a handyman. He's the gadget guy. You know, he just does everything. He can't fix this. This problem is too big for anybody to fix. Real spiritual problems, and sin is a real and spiritual problem, requires spiritual solutions. First, you need someone with the knowledge of what exactly is going on and an accurate knowledge at that, not just guessing or I think so or this is what I feel is the problem. Secondly, you need someone who has the tools and the know-how to apply that knowledge and that wisdom toward the problem in order to fix it. And thirdly, you need that person's willingness and capability to actually fix the problem. And that's what we're looking at with God, is that He is the one with the transcendent knowledge. He has the tools and He's willing and able to apply them. Here's the thing. The world has about 7 billion people in it. There's not a single person on the face of the earth now or in 100 years from now or 100 years ago that is capable of fixing the problems of the human soul. You cannot fix spiritual problems with human or earthly solutions. You need a spiritual solution. We saw in the Old Testament that the animals that were offered up and the blood that was poured out, there was many, many animals, thousands upon thousands, rivers of blood, and that didn't take away the sins of the people by themselves. It wasn't until Christ offered Himself that the world could look to a Savior, because the animals couldn't save them. So the solution is not, we need more animals, or we need more blood. No, we need a better solution. Better solution altogether. God's laws and morality, His principles are not meant to burden us. They're not meant to make us miserable or do us harm. I get the feeling sometimes people think that's what it's all about. You know, like He's trying to cramp someone's style. He's trying to impose upon them somehow. I used to be able to do everything I want, and now God's coming down and, you know, making my life miserable. I mean, you get that sometimes from people. Rather, He is giving us these things to guide us home. He's giving us what we need, and what we need is stability, and we need structure, and we need discipline. I don't mean punitive discipline when I say that. I mean just simply something by which to teach us and train us what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to go. We need a navigation system for the soul. These are things that we all desperately need. In fact, there are things that we all desperately want, truth be told. We need to be able to follow God. We need to know where we stand with Him. We need to know where He stands. And we need to know that if we do follow Him, that it will all turn out for good. It won't just be a pie-in-the-sky fairy tale Hollywood ending, you know, like where everything always turns out all right and they all walk off into the sunset. We really can have everything turn out all right. In fact, even better than we could imagine. We can know where we stand with the one who has the greatest power and the highest authority ever. That's pretty impressive. Imagine trying to build a house without stability or structure. Imagine you're using lumber that has the consistency of wet spaghetti. Imagine the concrete that you're using is like jello. Imagine the wiring you're using is like spider's web. Or imagine the pipes that you're trying to put in don't even hold water. Or let's just imagine this. There's no gravity to hold everything down. Imagine that. Well, you can't build a house with that sort of thing. And you can't build a marriage that way either. You can't build a family. You can't build a congregation. You can't build a nation if you don't have things that have fixed and absolute values to them and a God who has told us how to put it all together. People claim they don't want stability and structure because it cramps their style, but the fact is it's impossible to function without it. Jesus, by implication, says that it's harder to live by God's law than against him. But the problem is not the laws themselves. The problem is, and he tells us over and over, our resistance to that, our refusal to allow those laws to be implemented, or the neglect of those laws. Imagine, for example, you build your house on the, say, the San Andreas fault line there in California. I mean, you have an actual fault line, and you decide, you know what, this is a good place for a house. And then you build a house there. Well, nothing happens for years, but then suddenly the big earthquake comes, and your house is decimated, and you wonder why. And then you blame God for, you know, destroying your house. It wasn't God who destroyed your house. It was an earthquake. And the reason why the earthquake destroyed your house is because of where you chose to build it. Where are people building their houses today? I'm not talking about their physical houses now. I'm talking about their lives, their spiritual houses, if you will. Anyone can be a lawless transgressor. Anyone can be a sinner. It takes no intelligence. It takes no skill. It takes no courage. Any simpleton, any tool, if you will, can be a sinner. It takes a real man and a real woman to conform to a heavenly standard. We need real men and we need real women to step up and step into the gap. You know that people admire Jesus not because he was a lawbreaker, but just the opposite. He was a law keeper. He offered perfect obedience, flawless behavior. Many people, including non-Christians, admire Jesus' love and his obedience and his compassion, his morality, his justice. They admire all those things, but many also fail to realize that what drove all those things is his deep respect and reverence for his Father and for law itself and for truth and for righteousness. These are the things that motivate us to be law keepers. It's not just law by itself, but there's a deeper, nobler sense of understanding that there has to be something that drives me to do this thing here that is better than myself, higher than myself. Laws and commandments are not goals in themselves. They lead us in the right direction, very much like train tracks. They lead us in the right direction. Have you ever looked at train tracks very closely? I've always been impressed with that. It doesn't matter for how many miles they extend, they're always the same distance apart, always very well established, always going in a certain direction. And that's impressive to me because that models, in essence, what we should have in God, what God is offering to us. Someone will say, well, God will save us because he loves us. And here's a person who confuses God care for what happens to us with him taking responsibility for us or even from us. A parent might say, I love my children, but I need them to make their own decisions and even live with the consequences. It doesn't stop them from loving. It actually is a manifestation of love. And God is doing that too. He's showing his love for us by allowing us to choose our own course, but he always provides for us a direction, and he always gives us the warning, and he always gives us the inspiration to go in the right way. A point is making here is that we cannot admire Jesus for his virtue and at the same time ignore virtue and hope that everything's going to be all right. The same Jesus whom we all admire said, if you will not listen to this message of mine and act upon it, then you will perish. John chapter 3:16, one of the most famous passages and well-known biblical passages in the world. God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son that whoever believed in him shall not perish. He tells you in that verse that you will perish if you don't listen to him. And people aren't listening to him. And yet they think that they won't perish. People aren't really listening to what God is saying. Can't get better, can't get improved, can't be progressive if you have no idea where you are or where you're going. You can't think that you're better because you're ahead of where you used to be if you're just as lost now as you were before. As a result, America has become, and I hate to say this, I'm sad to say this, the most godless, the most perverse, the most idiotic nation in its history. We as a nation are perishing. Our compass is broken. As it stands, we are drifting aimlessly. And yet everyone is saying, oh, this feels good. This feels right. Party on, dude, right? And that's what everyone is saying. Jesus has given us all the means by which to travel safely through this life and into the life to come. Sadly, most refuse to listen and obey. Many are giving allegiance to an inferior and lesser authority. It's just like throwing the steering wheel out the window. This is going to have a very bad ending. Our audience here is largely Christians, so I would think that a lot of us are probably, at least in our hearts, going, amen, preach on. But non-Christians are not the only ones in need of direction. We need it too. The unconverted world is not the only ones who are resisting and ignoring and kicking against the goads. Sometimes we're doing it ourselves. Luke chapter 6, verse 46, Jesus says very candidly, he says, why do you call me Lord, Lord? Do not do what I say. What he means there is, why are you using the name Lord when you don't treat me like Lord? If I am the Lord, then you would listen to me. If I were your Lord, then you would follow me. My fear is that this is a very strong indictment against many Christians who are quick to call Jesus Lord in prayers and songs and at the Lord's Supper and in our services, but that doesn't mean that he is Lord in our hearts. 1 Peter 3:15 says, first of all, before we go out preaching the word and start defending our gospel and defending the truth, first of all, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. If you haven't done that, then you are not prepared to do anything else. Just because we know the right direction in which to go doesn't mean we're automatically going there. Don't confuse knowledge of what it means to obey with actual obedience, because they're not the same thing. Just because you have good intentions doesn't mean you have a good heart, or that you are doing good works, or that you have a good faith. We all want to have good intentions, and we all want credit for that, of course. But don't confuse the two things and think that just because your intentions are good, therefore God must think that you are good. That's not how this works, and we should know better of all people. People in the world are desperately in need of divine direction, but so are we, every single Christian. We have not just arrived because we've been baptized and go to church and sing songs. You need direction, just like I do. It is not within yourself to guide your steps or to lead yourself to God. Remember what Paul told the Galatians there in Galatians chapter 3, verse 3. He says, now let me get this straight, if I could paraphrase it. You began your journey with God through the Spirit, but now that that's happened, now you can fix everything through your own human effort. That just doesn't work. And he says, are you so foolish to think that? Your marriage needs direction, and if indeed you are married, just because your marriage is scriptural, because that's where everyone goes, as long as you got a scriptural marriage, well, that doesn't mean you are, or that your spouse is, or that your relationship conforms to what Jesus would have it to be. Just because two Christians are married doesn't mean that they are both serving Christ, or that they are both following the laws of God. You can save a marriage, but a marriage cannot save you. We shouldn't forget that. Your family needs direction. Your children need direction. I get the idea sometimes that Christians think they could just throw food and clothes and toiletries and toys and iPads at their children and call it training up their children. You can't just drag your children to church and expect them to morph into a spiritual allegiance to the Lord. They need to be led, and parents, you are the one responsible to leading them. That's a definition of leadership at its most basic level. First of all, you know the way to go. Secondly, you're going that way yourself. And thirdly, you are actively inspiring others, in this case, your children, to follow you. That's good parenting. Congregation needs direction. Many elders confuse being elders with actual leadership and providing direction. I've seen that in so many different congregations. You're not an airplane pilot just because you sit in a cockpit of an airplane, all right? So don't confuse being in a position with the ability to do something. Many members think that, well, we have elders and deacons and a preacher and teachers. We have good leadership. That doesn't mean anything if those people don't know the direction that they're supposed to go. The Bible is not a textbook that we're forced to learn and forced to read. A bunch of terms in there, and verses, and names nobody can pronounce. Rather, it serves as a kind of owner's manual for human life, written by the very one who gave us life, the one who created us, who created human life. Or you might say it's a prescription for virtuous life given to us by the great physician himself. Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in the darkness, but will have the light of life. What's interesting is what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, he who knows about me, he who sings songs about me, he who has my name on their church sign out front. He doesn't say that, but he who follows me. Because no one can be a true disciple who does not follow the master. Matthew 16:24, we should have this memorized if you're a member of this congregation because we go over it, I think, every Sunday. You know, if anyone wishes to follow me, Jesus says, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Follow me. Which direction do you think Jesus is going? He's going the straight course, straight ahead, and we should follow him. We're also told in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14, do not be bound together with unbelievers. What partnership of righteousness and lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? This isn't stuff I'm making up, people. This is being pulled right out of the owner's manual. You can't be bound to Jesus Christ and have beliefs or relationships or a lifestyle that contradicts what he taught, either actively or by neglecting what he said. This is not following the Lord. This is not walking straight. And this is what nobody wants to hear. Because we'd rather hear, let's find a way to accommodate this person's lifestyle, behavior, bent, if you will. You know, let's find a way to accommodate that, not cause too much waves, not rock the boat. But that's not what it says. We of all people should know that. Because when we became Christians, we all made a solemn promise to be lights and salt, lights of the world, salt of the earth. And to sanctify Christ as our Lord, to honor him. There's a great quote I came across here in one of the commentaries. It says, the Christian pledge is to a life of purity. Christians ought to have a standard of honor and honesty, of self-control and chastity, of discipline and consideration, far above the standards of the world. The simple fact is that the world will never have any use for Christianity unless it can prove that it produces the best men and women. The best men and women, not mediocre, not half-rate, not average, not churchgoers, the best men and women. And if we are not proving ourselves to be the best men and women in our society, then what are we really saying about Christianity itself? Are we really striving to do that? Now, if you are, I commend you. I know some of you are striving hard to do that. You're swimming upstream, you're going against the tide, and all those other little metaphors we could use there. And I appreciate that. Better yet, far better yet, God appreciates that. But think about this passage here in Philippians chapter 2, verse 15 and 16. Paul says, prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life. There are a couple of things he says here. First of all, prove yourselves. In other words, make it real. People get upset sometimes when you actually force them, compel them, hold them accountable to what they claim to believe. Have you ever noticed that? Prove yourselves. Make sure you're the real thing. Make sure you're authentic. More than just mere talk and good intentions. Anybody can talk. Children of God above reproach means that God expects from you more than he expects from the world. When people in the world mess up and say bad things and do dumb things, I expect that. When Christians do that, who ought to know better, that is not something we should expect. And if it does happen, it's something that we should correct, especially in ourselves. Lights in the world, we have a moral responsibility to provide a godly influence. And we're supposed to be holding fast to the word of life. That means more than just showing up for a Bible study or a worship service or even, with all due credit here, to this meeting right here. It means more than that. Here's another way of looking at it. If where we need to be is different than where we are now, if where we need to be is different than where we are now, change is necessary. And the sooner, the better. Everyone says, I want to grow. Well, that's good. But you realize that in order to grow, you've got to change for the better. We can't stop the world from taking the direction it's taking, but we can stop. Here's the good news. We can stop ourselves from adopting that world and adapting to it. First of all, we need to recognize the seriousness of the situation. Secondly, we need to identify what we're doing to conform to the world rather than being transformed by the renewing of our mind. Thirdly, we need to confront those things that are holding us back and standing in our way and are stumbling blocks to us. And then fourthly, we just need to make the change. I know that all sounds easy. It's a simple plan, honestly, and it can be very difficult to put into practice. Jesus says it will be like cutting off your right hand or gouging out your right eye. While the ultimate responsibility to all this does lie with you, we put this series together to help you because I want to help. And I think we speakers want to help. And I would like to say this congregation in supporting and hosting all this wants to help. So the rest of the series will not only define the problems of the world without direction, but it will also offer biblical solutions. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about political correctness. The world wants us all to be politically correct, but God is not interested in politics nor conforming to the world's version of whatever is correct in its own view. Jesus was never afraid to speak the truth, and neither should we be afraid to speak the truth. We're also going to talk about pornography. It's just the most distasteful subject, but it's a problem, and it's one of the most insidious and noxious forms of modern idolatry. The worship of the human body and sex and the creature rather than the creator, it's exactly what Paul told us not to do. It destroys the mind as well as the soul, and sadly many Christians are caught up in this. We're also going to talk about an evil and adulterous generation. That's a phrase that comes right out of Matthew 16. Dan's going to talk about that. Jesus called his people an evil and adulterous generation. And if he were here, he would probably look at our own generation and say, yep, this is an evil and adulterous generation too. The world is filled with evil and it is filled with adultery, literally and spiritually. It seeks a wide path of destruction. It's going in the wrong direction and it will have an awful end if it keeps on that direction. You can tell a lot about a person by the kind of words they use. Listen to the conversations of the modern American, and it's painfully clear that the world is filled with profanity and blasphemies and gutter talk. We speak crooked words. We talk perversely. We have become a vulgar people, and you've got to believe that this is trickling into the churches. Dan will identify the straight and crooked paths on Sunday morning, what makes them the way that they are. And this is not just interesting information or, you know, a good topic for a lesson. It is absolutely critical that we know what God says about the straight path as well as the crooked one. And it's not enough to identify the right path from wrong. We need to also do something about that. So we need to come out and be separate. Brent will be talking about that tomorrow, or Sunday rather, afternoon. This is not just God's helpful suggestion. Wouldn't it be nice if you could do this? But rather that no one will be with God who does not come out and be separate. First of all, in their baptism. Secondly, for the rest of their life. And at the end of it all, divine judgment is coming. Regardless of what you do, regardless of what I do, regardless of what we do. Whether we do the right thing or we do the wrong thing. Whether we go forward and just like Joshua was told, and you know, not to the right or to the left, but straight ahead. Or whether we just slough off and get lazy and become soft and undisciplined. Regardless of what we choose to do, divine judgment is coming. Remember that Noah prepared an ark during sunny weather when no one expected rain or a flood. But the floods are coming. Likewise, God is coming. Christ is coming. Your death is coming. Trying to remain faithful to God in a world without direction is not easy. At the same time, be thankful that we can do it. It is doable. Tough, difficult, but doable. Jesus Christ did not die on a cross just so that we could sit on church pews and hear sermons and sing songs. What we're doing here, what we always do here, is training, education, motivation, encouragement. This is not a replacement for godly living, the straight path, the narrow gate. It's not a replacement for that, but this is good. This helps us to get on that path and to stay there. But even if we have not done well until now, there is still time. There is still opportunity. Thankfully, there is still hope. I'd like to leave you with Hebrews chapter 12, verse 12 and 13, where the writer there says to people who are struggling in their faith, he says, "Therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed." This is what we want. This is what we need. This is what God seeks. He seeks healing and restoration. It's not a time to be timid. It's not a time to be fearful. It's not a time to be distracted or inattentive. It's not a time to be lazy. It's not a time to be unconcerned. But it is a time to stand with Christ and be counted among the faithful, and to set our hearts and our minds above this world, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. It's time for that. I'm not saying it hasn't been done, and I'm not saying you haven't done it. What I'm saying is, for those who haven't been doing it, who've maybe never done it, it's time. It's time right now to do that. Maybe it's time for you this evening to make that decision, to even to make it public. That might be your need to do that tonight. Call it an invitation if you want to, but we're going to just allow you to come forward during the song that's going to be sung here in just a minute if you want to make that public. But I tell you what, even if you don't do that, my strong urging is for you to keep coming to hear more of the explanation of the problems, but also, thankfully, the biblical solutions to what ails us, so that we cannot get bogged down anymore, but rather we can go forward and move ahead in a straight direction. That's my lesson. Let's stand and sing the song that Kyle has selected for us.